This is Rock Isn't Dead, It's Just Sleeping. With your hosts, William Whitebread and Mark Audio Slave Stewart.
Welcome back, motherfuckers, to another episode of Rock Isn't Dead, It's Just Sleeping with yours truly, Willie Whitebread.
Mark the Audio Slave.
Last week, we had Renegade Rick Lane on with us to do a little bit about the origins of metal, and I think we vastly underestimated the size of the subgenres of this group of musicians.
It's a lot of talking. It's a lot of talking about that metal.
Talking about these metal motherfuckers around here. So, we decided to do this week's episode on thrash metal. Let's go into a little bit of what thrash metal is, where it started, what it's about, and what it constitutes. Shall we?
Yeah, but we shall do it.
We shall. So, thrash metal began in Southern California, and you've got the big four bands. The big four bands, when you hear thrash metal, speed metal, you think of the big four. You think about Anthrax, you think about Slayer, you think about Megadeth, and you think about Metallica. Am I right, or am I right?
You are right.
Yes. Okay. In case you're wondering where the term thrash metal came from, it was coined by a journalist named Malcolm Dome from Kerrang! Magazine in one of their issues in 1984, and they were talking about one of Anthrax's song, actually, called Metal Thrashing Mad. It was off one of their Fistful of Metal album.
Interesting.
So that's kind of where thrash metal came from. Which is interesting. And so I guess thrash metal, the whole bring about of thrash metal was, obviously it was influenced by the bands that we talked about last week. Mm-hmm. Deep Purple, Blue Cheer, Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, kind of that, the heavier toned guitars.
And they just brought it up a notch.
Well, they wanted, like we were talking about, it's the same thing that almost every subgenre, other than probably in the last 10 years, they want it faster, stronger, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they want, it faster, harder, stronger. And what was that little quip about that? What was that?
Oh, that was a
Kanye West?
No. I'll think of it. Keep going.
And interesting enough, some of the other 70s bands had a little bit of a thrash thing going on. I don't know if any of you guys out there have ever heard this song by Queen, Stone Cold Crazy, off their 1974 Sheer Heart Attack album.
Yeah.
You've heard that?
Oh, yeah.
That was really, that was said to be one of the first thrash metal songs to ever come out. They considered that thrash metal.
They pioneered it.
Yeah, pioneered it.
Good for them.
And funny enough, too, is in the 1990s, I think it was 1992, James Hetfield from Metallica actually joined the surviving members of Queen and Tony Iommi mm-hmm. at a Freddie Mercury benefit show, maybe a tribute show.
Probably a tribute.
Yeah, yeah. A tribute show. And they covered that song, which I think is pretty fucking
and
cool.
And they also put that on the B-side of their Enter Sandman single cassette that I had bought back in the old, when Black first came out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the B-side, Stone Cold Crazy.
Wow.
And it was tight.
Yeah, And you know what? The instrumentals of that song don't sound very different from Queen's version and Metallica's version. Obviously, there's a little bit more distortion.
Right. Yeah.
But the speed, the melodies, the bridges, the choruses, they're all almost exact.
Yeah.
And which is cool, because you would never think Queen would produce something like that.
Yeah. They surprised everybody with a lot of stuff.
Right.
Know, back in those days.
Right.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, yeah, that operatic stuff. Yeah. So you had mentioned something last week that I mentioned.
Oh, before, let me stop you. Daft Punk was that reference.
Daft Punk.
That was the reference.
There we go. There we go. I never really got much into them. I don't know much about them. They had the one of my favorite four-letter words in there, punk, but yeah. I never really listened. What kind of music are they?
Electronic.
That's why I've never heard of them.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned a band last week that I haven't actually heard much of, Diamond Head, right?
No, it would be King Diamond.
Oh, King Diamond. That's right. Who you were talking about.
Right. That's one of the founding metal godfathers. Mm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I got it mixed up, but I looked up a little bit about a band, Diamond Head. Have you ever heard of them?
No, I haven't.
They were an English metal band. They were formed in, I think it was 76, and they followed along kind of with the British metal movement, but they threw a lot more heavy thrashing guitar in there than the other British metal guys that were coming through at that time in the mid, early mid, and you know throughout the entire 70s pretty
yeah,
much.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Def Leppard, Saxon, Judas Priest, and Iron Maiden, and also Raven.
Mm-hmm.
Raven was a big influence on them as well, and I think it all is very interesting to me because I didn't know too much about the metal scene. I mean, I knew I liked it and all that kind of stuff, but I didn't know kind of the lineage behind it. And it's interesting enough that these bands and these movements were doing the same exact thing that, you know, was happening since the early 60s. You know, it was the British movement,
yeah,
and it was the U.S. movement.
Right.
Then it was the U.S. movement, then it was the British movement. Mm-hmm. You know, they did it with the, you know, the classic rock. They did it with the psychedelic stuff. They did it with punk rock. Right. They
like,
did it with
like, all like we were talking about last week, they take the American bands and send them to Britain mm-hmm. to make it in Britain before they can come back to the States and make
right.
it here.
Right.
So it was kind of like reverse Britain invasions,
and that's
with
what
American
with,
bands.
That's what they did with Hendrix too.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
Like, it's kind of a little bizarre.
Oh well, if they like you over there, then I guess you can come back and
no,
here.
Seriously,
well, that's
right.
That's how it was.
I was watching a bunch of documentaries about thrash metal, and there's this band Hyrax that was doing that. They were mad that they didn't go to Britain. They're like, "Fuck, man, we should have gone to England.
That's where
and
it
recorded,
was happening. Yeah.
And then came back over here because over there in England, they were scooping up every fucking thing they could get.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and they were coming
they
through
were,
hard and fast,
they,
dude.
They were. We want American bands here. We want American bands
right.
touring around England.
Right. And yeah. I think it's because they didn't have a blues movement. Like,
well,
we
I don't
did.
Think it was just like they were centered in England, but they probably did like a whole little European tour thing, like small,
oh, yeah.
small time, you know, tours.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It hit Germany and Norway and all the metal.
Well, that's where a lot of the our first thrash metal guys that we're talking about, Metallica, that's where they started. That's yeah. where they started. I mean, they did a couple small tours here in the U.S. when Kill 'Em All came out, but for the most part, they were touring over there,
mm-hmm.
especially Megadeth. Megadeth was over there a lot.
Yeah.
You know.
Did you see what Dave Mustaine just said about on an article I saw last night? I guess he's, you know, because he's got his situation, his medical situation going on. He
What's wrong with him?
He's got throat cancer.
Oh.
Pretty bad.
Probably from doing that for fucking 30 years.
Well, he was saying like he really wished he can get all the years back that he put out on touring and just being on the road because he feels like he lost a lot of life.
No, he lost a lot of life because he shot fucking $2 million worth of smack
yeah,
into
yeah,
his arm
course.
Over 30 fucking years.
Of course.
Which is why
yeah,
he
chain
lost
smoked
a lot of
on top of it.
Yeah, don't give me that fucking bullshit. I wish I wouldn't have toured the world with all
I,
these
yeah,
fantastic
and made
bands.
All this money.
You whiny
well,
fuck.
So what would you rather have done, Dave? Just sat in a gutter and done your heroin?
Yeah, right, you whiny fuck. Everybody gets all self-righteous when something
just,
bad
I was
happens
just telling
to
you
them.
The title of the article that he was
yeah.
talking about.
Well, there's, and we're going to get into this a little bit with Megadeth and Metallica and stuff like that, but like after researching all of these guys the way that I did, and listening to their documentaries and their, you know, their interviews and things like that, Dave Mustaine was an asshole.
Yeah. That's probably why he was booted from Metallica.
That's exactly why he was booted from Metallica. He was mm-hmm. a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
And they got sick of his violence and his drug abuse and his alcohol. I mean, the dude couldn't even fucking record.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he couldn't even be
and then he was
counted
trying to be,
on.
Then he was trying to be the boss of the band on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
This is my band.
Yeah, could you imagine that? Somebody coming in all sloppy fucking drunk. This is my fucking band. Yeah,
you
dude.
You don't like it, you leave.
Yeah, dude, you can't even hold down a fucking soda.
Yeah.
Much less a band. Get the fuck out. You know?
Right, right.
Get out. But anyway, so moving a little bit forward, Motorhead. We didn't talk much about them last
Let
time.
Me.
Fucking Lemmy, dude.
Tell you what, Motorhead was, they were kind of like the same time that they were getting big, the skateboarding was getting big in America.
Oh, yeah.
And all the skaters, all they wanted to listen to all day long was punk and thrash metal.
Bro.
I mean,
well,
you,
they were
you
synonymous.
If it was 1990, you open a Thrasher magazine, you would see a giant Motorhead. You
yeah,
know,
Motorhead,
available,
Ted Kennedy's.
Available now, Motorhead, you know.
Right, right.
So... like that was a big part of their fan base
yeah.
was the skateboarders.
And I think
then.
That's really funny too, because they were so different yet so much the same that they almost had like a deep rooted hated respect for each other.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
They were like, fuck you, but I understand you.
See, then skateboarding kind of evolved into what it is today, and now it's kinda yeah. like, you know, Post Malone and
yeah.
you know,
Well, back then,
a lot of rap stuff.
Yeah, back then, skateboarding was huge.
Oh, dude. If you didn't skate, then you were kind of a dork. I mean, honestly, if you were either a jock, a skateboarder, skate rats, as we call them.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of the same even in my era of growing up, the late 90s and the early 2000s. That skateboarding was still huge, dude. Yeah. Like, if you didn't skate, you weren't shit.
Like, when I first started skateboarding, it was before the skateboard, the decks had the double, you know, sided.
Oh, yeah, you were back in, like, the Tony Alva and Stacy Peralta days and
correct,
shit.
Correct,
the Lords of Dogtown, that's where you were coming through.
Yeah, my first board was a Nuke Boy, and it was a picture of this little baby coming out of, like, a hole in the wall, and it was all, like, punk, you know, like a mohawk and shit.
Yeah.
And, it had, like, rails on the side and a big tail on the one side. It was heavy as shit.
Oh, yeah.
But it was Pal Peralta.
Yeah, Pal Peralta, man. That's probably where World Industries, that's probably what World Industries turned into, all that, like, cartoony shit that they used to do. But, yeah, man, Motorhead was huge, and they're actually considered to be the godfathers of the thrash metal scene. They were when it really, really took a turn, especially in the late 70s, interestingly enough, with their 1979 album, Overkill. That's the first time that the double bass got commercialized.
Oh, no shit.
I mean, I'm sure people were doing it.
Yeah.
But nobody was putting it on record, and you damn sure weren't buying it in an album at a record store.
Now, that was probably the just two bass drums next to each other. That wasn't the actual double bass pedal.
Not the double bass pedal. No, no, no.
Yeah, gotcha.
No, it was Filthy Phil Taylor, man. That was their drummer. And it was actually on the song Overkill.
Okay.
And people lost their fucking minds. Could you imagine that? I mean, because that's something new, man. That's something real new.
Yeah.
Like, you're used to that do-do-do-do-do-do
right.
shit, you know? And then all of a sudden you get do 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 do. They're like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? Because that just gets your heart going because, you know, the drummer's the heart of the band. So
Def Leppard can't do this.
Yeah, well, he's got two legs.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he just doesn't have two arms.
Def Leppard can do this.
Yeah, he can do this. He just can't do the thrashing around on the cymbals that as well as he used to.
I actually watched a little video the other day about him and how he uses his drums, and it's kind of interesting how many like different mechanisms he has to have.
I'm sure,
you know, to compensate for a normal drummer.
Yeah, I just love that they kept him.
Oh yeah,
I love that.
That's what being in a band should be all about.
That's it.
You know,
that's the perfect depiction. Like, where you got these guys like Megadeth and Anthrax and not so much Slayer, but Megadeth, Anthrax, and Metallica. They were throwing members around all fucking day long, especially Megadeth. Megadeth had like 16 different members in it.
Well, Mustaine was firing people left and right.
Left and right.
He says, my band, get out.
Yeah, my band, get out. Exactly. And to see somebody like hold the family dynamic within the band together, like the guys in Def Leppard did, that's something to respect, man.
Yeah.
That's really something cool. And the guy's a pretty good drummer.
I mean, there's tons of bands that do make it through. I mean, look at the Rolling Stones, you know, I mean, it's just all about the brotherhood. And if you can tolerate, basically, I heard somebody famous, I forget who it was. They said, if you can tolerate somebody for like 90% of the time and not want to kill them, then musically it will come, you know, if it hasn't come yet, it's going to blossom later.
It'll come naturally.
The most important part is can you live with that person on the road? That's the most important.
And can you have fun and go through the hard times?
They said
if
you weed through all musicians out there, you'll find that there's only like 10% of the people left that you can actually live with on the road.
Right.
You know, so that's how they whittle down for new band members.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Well, I don't know if there's a whole lot of touring going on in modern music now, do you think?
Oh, yeah.
Is there?
Oh, yeah. It's bands on tour all the time.
Is there?
What do you mean?
I don't mean, I just don't feel like it's like it used to be. You know? Mm-mm. Like the family dynamic behind it. I feel like there's so much technology and so much.
Oh, well, yeah.
You know, I heard a, don't ask me where, I don't remember, but I heard this Panic at the Disco fucking quip. They're like, well, yeah, he likes to take the plane where those two like to take a bus, and then this one just drives himself.
Yeah, there's no camaraderie.
I mean. Not a whole lot of touring. I'm sure there's touring, but there's not like family experience.
Because back then they didn't look at it like a business like they do today.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at it more like, you know, let's just go show everybody what we got. And that's what they did, and that's why they're so infamous.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's what it takes, I guess. You just gotta, there's one thing to be into music, and there's one thing to completely say, fuck everything else in my life revolves around music.
Right.
You know what I mean? I wake up, music. I eat lunch, music. I go to sleep, music.
Right.
Friday night comes, not partying, playing music. Partying while playing music. That's all they're doing is playing music, studying music, music theory. That's it.
Right.
You know, I just don't know if there's much of that around anymore, because everything that you hear nowadays has already been done. It's kind of like the same in the cinematic sense of like the cinema you see out today. What are the you know, big companies, Disney, Sony, what are they putting out? They're putting out shit that already exists, just different renditions of it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Regurgitated bullshit.
All regurgitated bullshit.
Even Tool's doing that.
That's going to be our album review, and I got a couple of fucking things to say about the new Fear Inoculum record.
Now, I had a guy about 10 years ago, a buddy of mine, his name is Don, and he was in a band. He created a band called Cypher.
Yeah.
And what he did is he copyrighted all the songs right off the bat. Everything's copyrighted. So he called me up one day, and he's like, hey, would you like to be our second guitar player? So yeah, I was like, cool. So I went and I did a few jam sessions with him, and we jammed pretty well. And so then he pulled me aside. He goes, hey, would you be able to leave your family and go on tour with us, you know, just like, you know, here and there, you know, for a month or two? I'm like, yeah, I don't see why not, as long as, you know, we're all going to get paid. He's like, well, the thing is, we're all not going to get paid the same amount of money, and you're going to get paid this much, and I'm going to get paid this much. And I'm like, well, then I'm not really on board with that. And that's kind of like where I'm coming from with everybody looks at like more of like a business.
Right.
Instead of like, you know, being, well, just being out there and being original.
That's another thing, too, with being the new guy in the band. You know, and
that would have been fine, but he got into the whole thing like, well, all my songs are copyrighted, and so like, you know, this is, you know, you'll never make more than this if you join the band for a full-fledged member. Like, he was going in depth with it all. I'm like, dude, and they disbanded like probably like, you know, like less than a year later.
Yeah,
they had t-shirts made and everything. And then
were they big?
No, they weren't. He took his mommy's money and made a nice album for like $8,000.
Yeah.
And then he thought he was going to be big. And I kind of thought so too. He had like a Billy Corgan type voice.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, sounded good.
And when was this?
Oh, God. It's probably about 15, 16 years ago now.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, another thing too is when you have a family and shit, it's kind of difficult to do stuff like that. Like with these guys, like in Metallica and Megadeth and all these bands, they started when they were like 16 years old.
Right.
You know what I mean? And they knew that they were going to make something of it by like 18, 19.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They didn't have any bills and shit.
Right.
You know, to jump into a band in like your mid-20s, late-20s.
And then just get like, oh, well, we're going to pay you probably $200 a week, if that.
Yeah, well, I got light bills and shit.
Right.
Like, I got to eat and shit and medical insurance. Like, nah.
Well, I'm just glad I didn't jump on that bandwagon.
Yeah, no shit. So, anyway. So, yeah.
The bandwagon.
The bandwagon. Yeah, pun completely intended. So, yeah. So, during the same time, like I said, you know, Motorhead was coming out, and that was the first, that was the thrash scene. You know what I mean? You heard glimpses of thrash, you know, where they pulled their influences from and stuff like that. But the first, like, this is thrash metal, Motorhead. Motorhead was fucking thrash metal.
Yeah, for God's sakes.
Yeah, yes. That's what they wanted, and that's what they were the label of the scene, you know.
Right.
And so, but see, also at the same time, there's a lot of different mechanics in music in the music industry going on at the same time that thrash metal was happening, right? Because you had the glam metal that was going on.
Yeah.
In the, you know, the mid late 70s. That was starting to surface, which was a rendition. And then that all happened because of stuff like we talked about last week. You know, the showmanship and the theatrics of Kiss and Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That met the vocals of the thrash metal guys and the scene of David Bowie and, you know, the New York Dolls.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. All that, you got the theatrics in there, you got the sound, and then you've got the look, and all that slammed together.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got glam metal.
Yeah.
So you had glam metal going on at the same time, and on the other side of the fence, you had the hardcore punk kids, the Black Flag kids, the Dead Kennedys, Minor Threat.
Fugazi.
Yeah, Fugazi over here. You know, you had them going on. Over there. Not over here, over there. Okay.
Yeah.
So you had that going on, and so I feel like with the glam metal stuff, the British metal movement,
yeah,
and then the punk stuff,
mm-hmm.
all that combined into one, you mix it up, and you drink your thrash metal.
And then Lemmy popped out with his moly, moly, moly on his face.
Yeah.
Here I am, let's do this shit.
Yeah. I feel like they were that whole band just got started with a bunch of guys sitting in the backyard just like, man. Yeah.
I'm sick of being a Hell's Angel. Me too. Let's start a band.
Let's start a band, motherfucker. This shit's dumb.
Yeah. You know, we're going to get killed.
Yeah, we're going to get killed or kill killing. Yeah. Kill getting killed. Man, that sounds good. Do it again. So
that's how I always pictured them starting out.
Yeah.
Playing for like Hell's Angels parties and shit.
Yeah. They're just out like the drummer just like stops flipping burgers for a second and runs over there. You know,
let's put two of these drums together.
Yeah. Oh, man, that sounds cool, too. But so, yeah, I feel like that's exactly how it all began. And then you have a little band that comes out of Southern California, Huntington Beach, in 1981.
The Beach Boys?
No, but also funny you should mention that is that was also good for mentioning that. That was a big influence on heavy metal that we know today. Dick Dale.
Dick
Dale.
King of Surf.
King of Surf. His fucking licks, who back then was playing that fast?
I don't know.
Nobody.
But it was horrible the way he went out.
Yeah.
If you know about that story.
Not much.
Well, he was in his 80s, and it was just last year, and he was still touring, even though he had stage 4 rectal cancer.
Rectal cancer.
The erectical. The erectical. Yeah.
The erectical.
But he was forced to tour and forced to do that to pay for his meds and his hospital visits and all that stuff. So he couldn't stop touring, otherwise he would have died. You know, he would have died a lot sooner. It's kind of sad. And the Beach, go back to the Beach Boys. Did you know that Charlie Manson tried out for the Beach Boys?
No.
Yeah.
What?
He went to Brian Wilson's farm or whatever in California back when they were looking for another member.
What?
And, yeah, but before the killings and before he went completely out of his gourd.
He's not going to be on trial. Hey, can I join the Beach Boys?
He did something at the farm. I forget what it was, but it was something that Brian didn't like. I don't know if it was like he pushed a dog away really rough or something like that. He was kind of just like turned off about his demeanor. And so, yeah.
Good call.
Yeah.
Good call there.
Bye, Charlie. We don't want you.
Yeah. Great call. I'm just, you know what? My aspirations led to the Beach Boys, but I think what I'm going to do now is make this 50-gallon drum full of bullshit Kool-Aid and try to get people to drink it.
That was David What's-His-Face.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Manson's the one that created the cult to try to get people to kill people.
He had the women go out and kill Sharon Tate, that whole
thing. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I get my killers mixed
up. You're thinking of Jonestown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Jonestown. He wasn't the Kool-Aid guy. He was the I'm going to get you to kill somebody guy.
Right. Hey, I didn't tell him to do it. They just wanted to do it.
Yeah, did he actually kill anybody?
He didn't. No.
So how did he go to jail?
Because he was the mastermind behind it all and the cult leader and all that shit and the influence, I guess, on these.
I don't know. I didn't know you could go to jail. Impressionable young women.
Yeah, influence. There was a girl a couple years ago who went to jail. Remember, she was on the phone with her ex boyfriend or something, and he was sitting in a car.
Oh yeah, told him to kill him.
You should just do it. And then she went to jail.
Did she really?
She did. She did like a year and a half, and then she's out now, I believe.
Jesus Christ.
Yep.
But she's got, in modern society, shit like that'll fuck you up because you got to put that shit on a resume. You know what I mean?
That's right.
Coerced boyfriend into ending own life.
Well, I'm just going to put felony.
Yeah, I'll just put felony real quick. Yeah. I have my giant jug of water.
My God sakes, that thing's huge.
I know. That's what they all say.
Your jug of water.
Yeah. Well, that too. But anyway. On to the next. So, 1981, a little band called Metallica forms in Huntington Beach, Southern California, with founding members James Hetfield, Lars Ulrich, Dave Mustaine, and Ron McGovney on bass. That was the one thing about...
happened to Ron McGovney?
Ron McGovney, he got booted in like 82. He decided it wasn't for me. He's like,
I'm going to go to college.
No, well, yeah, pretty much. He wanted to get more into music production than actually playing the music. And so it was kind of like it was a mutual thing. It was a respected thing. It was like, yeah, I'm just going to go, guys. This really isn't for me. Because, you know, if you can see anything, and you can say a lot about Metallica, and plus I have a lot of my own different opinions about Metallica and the way that they do things and the way that they've said things in the past. But there is one thing you can say about them. Those guys are dedicated to their fucking music.
Oh, yeah.
That's one thing you can give them. You know, with all the bitching, and so they can act like pussies sometimes, but, you know, they were dedicated to their music.
And there was that time in the early 2000s where they were, going to break up.
Mm-hmm.
Because Lars doesn't know how to cope with James anymore.
Yeah, God damn it. Lars and James are like a two fucking little kids.
But dude. James always seems like the cool one, and Lars always seems like a little bitch.
I think that's what it is. Pardon my French. It's past my bedtime. So yeah, Ron McGovney, they, you know, he only played with them for like 81, 82. This is like pre Kill 'Em All. This
when,
is
and that's when Cliff Burton.
Yeah, came in. Yeah. This is when they were still touring in clubs. And,
Ron
and,
Burgundy, no shit.
Yeah, Ron Burgundy, Ron McGovney. That's when they were still playing in clubs and shit in Southern California. So
San Diego,
a whale's vagina. And so shortly after that, they met Cliff Burton at a show. I forget what band Cliff was playing with at the time. I forget.
Yeah, it's a band called Who Gives a Fuck.
Yeah, right. It was some. Well, I don't know.
It might have been. Yeah,
it might have been a good one. I don't know. I just can't remember which one.
So
it was.
He left before Hetfield got there.
Who? No, Hetfield was founding.
I mean before Mustaine got booted.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was playing with Mustaine. Very shortly.
Okay.
Very shortly. And so Cliff Burton, actually Metallica played a show at, I forget what club it was, and they played with Cliff and his band, and they had been trying to recruit Cliff for like months.
Okay.
And finally Cliff was like, okay, because he mostly played in San Fran, like the Bay Area and shit.
Yeah.
He's like, I'll join your band, but you have to move up to the Bay Area, and this is where we jam. Because that's where the scene was exploding, was the Bay Area.
Oh, yeah. I guess that makes sense.
That's where all of them, because all these bands started off in Southern California, except for Anthrax. Anthrax started off in New York.
Yeah.
But, you know, Slayer, Megadeth, and Metallica, they all started in Southern California.
Okay.
And the big thrash metal movement was happening primarily in the Bay Area of California, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So they move up there, they get Cliff, and then things start picking up. They start picking up the tours, they start... not tours, but they start playing at the, you know, at local
more venues.
Yeah, more venues.
Paid more.
Yeah, exactly.
More record executives, I'm sure, are coming to the shows.
Right.
And getting noticed.
Right. And that's one night they were playing over there in San Fran, and a concert promoter, John Zazula, who had just recently self-financed and formed his a new record company, Megaforce Records.
Okay.
Was at one of their shows, and he's like, hey, you guys are going to be a fucking slam dunk. Why don't you sign up with my label, and we'll go from there. And, you know, these young bands, they don't know anything about... I mean, they didn't think about the fact that this guy was, you know, self-financed. He's fucking using his dollars.
They're just saying, oh, man, we're going to get signed.
We're going to get
this
fucking
is it, guys.
Signed.
This is it.
Yeah, exactly. This is it. And so they signed with the newly established Megaforce Records, okay. which Megadeth also signed with at a later time, and I think Slayer did as well. I think.
Now, is that when Kill 'Em All was produced?
Well, kind of.
Is that the garage days?
Still? Yeah, this is the garage days. And they played for a little bit around local clubs and stuff like that. But then they flew to Rochester, New York to record Kill 'Em All.
Okay.
And this is when the rift between Mustaine and the band started happening.
Okay.
Right? Mustaine started coming into the studio. He was very, you know, inconsistent, and he wasn't trustworthy. Right? You know, yeah. They couldn't trust him to come in fucking worth a shit. And so this is where he gets booted. So about the third or fourth time he had come into the studio, they're like, all right, dude, well, you're a fuck up. Like, you can't even hold your shit together to, you know, to
record
this record.
We're just going to have James do the vocals.
Right.
You're out.
Yeah, you're done, man. Like, you're done. And so they booted Mustaine.
That's when Kirk was found in New York?
Yeah, same day. Hmm. Same fucking day. Kirk Hammett was playing guitar for Exodus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was playing guitar for Exodus, and that same afternoon, they recruited.
I know one of Kirk's main influences was a band called Rainbow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's a pretty cool band. If you ever check those out, them out.
And it's funny, too, because Kill 'Em All, you know what the name of that album was going to be?
What?
Metal Up Your Ass. That's what it was supposed to be.
That's why they have the T-shirt.
Hmm?
You never seen the Metallica T-shirts with the the knife in the hand coming out of the toilet and it says "Metal Up Your Ass" Metallica. Mm-mm. Yeah, it used to be an old T-shirt from the '80s that they used to produce.
Oh, that's funny.
And now it makes sense.
Yeah, that's what it was supposed to be called. And the record company, even this one dude, he was like, "Nah, we're not gonna call it Metal Up Your Ass." And so, yeah, Kill 'Em All. Yeah, Kill 'Em All. But there was a lot of tension very early on between Mustaine, because Mustaine essentially walked out with that mindset like you see in TV shows and shit, like, you'll never be anything without me. Yeah. Fuck you. I'm taking my guitar stand. You know what I mean?
See who the bigger rock star is.
Yeah. You ever seen that movie Rockstar?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of how it was. I'm taking my mic stand. That's my mic stand. That's kind of how it was. Like, Mustaine was pissed.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, absolutely understandable.
Yeah. And he also accused Hammett of stealing a shit ton of his guitar riffs.
Well, he might have.
He did, actually. And funny enough, he stole the Four Horsemen.
Okay.
Dave Mustaine wrote. And all they did was, like, change the melody up a little bit. And, and I think the tuning.
Right.
And Mustaine, there was a huge lawsuit about that. That Mustaine actually won.
Okay.
Because Mustaine named it Mechanics and re-released it on one of his albums.
And Kirk Hammett, the guitar player, he uses the wah pedal way too much. But it sounds good.
One of them. Master of the wah.
He is the master of the wah.
Yeah, master of the wah. Somebody else is the master of the wah. Tom Morello.
Yes.
Him and Tom Morello. Could you just imagine them sitting at a cookout like just wow, 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 wow. Just, well, fuck your wow. Yeah, they're just sitting there fucking battling each other like Dragon Force, like that Dragon Force guitar battle. They're just sitting there with two pedals just staring at each other. Wow, wow, wow. That should be funny as fuck.
Yeah.
But anyway, so 1983, Kill 'Em All is released. Not a huge success at first.
No, it was probably not until the next release. Then people went back and bought the first one.
Right. Kill 'Em All wasn't a huge release, but they did get a tour out of it. They were touring with their heroes at the time, which were Raven and then Venom. Venom is credited with being one of the first origins of black metal.
Yeah.
Not Norwegian black metal.
Yeah.
But black metal. So they were touring with those guys, and they made it to the Aardshock Festival in Zwolle, Netherlands, and they played in front of 7,000 people. And so they got a little bit of face time with that. And like we talked about before, mm-hmm. they started off in fucking Europe.
Yeah.
And that's when they started picking up speed. And so, you know, it was good. You know, they were starting to pick up stuff. And so the very next year, Kill 'Em All was released in 1983. And then you've got Ride the Lightning.
Which was one of my favorite albums.
Yes, definitely one of my favorite albums. Load and Reload are my two favorite albums. But Ride the Lightning is a close second.
Yeah, Master Puppets and Ride the Lightning. Yeah. All the early Metallica.
Yeah.
After Black, I kind of just went.
That's when I stopped listening.
No, you like Load.
Well, yeah. That's after Reload. I pretty much stopped listening.
I stopped
at like Garage Inc.
After Black, I stopped listening.
Death Magnetic and all that bull.
They came out. I mean, don't get me wrong. Black is a classic album, but they started selling out, in my opinion, when that after.
Well,
that
they followed the money.
Well, yeah. Can you blame them?
No, not at all. They follow the money. So with Ride the Lightning coming out in 1984, they had moved, you know, from their Southern California over to New York. They didn't move to New York, but that's where they were recording at. They moved over to the Sweet Silence Studios in Copenhagen, which is where they started recording, I think, their next two or three albums. So Ride the Lightning came out in 1984, which it was the first time that Metallica made the top 100 album chart list.
Which Fade to Black is a masterpiece.
Oh, it's fucking fantastic.
Yeah.
It's an absolute great song. Very great song.
Yeah.
And funny enough, for all you people out there that collect vinyl, if you ever come across a Ride the Lightning in green, the album is green because they fucked up and printed a bunch of copies. I think it was like 500 to 1,000 copies of the album in green.
What is that worth?
A lot of money.
I have it.
Do you?
No.
I want it. I'm breaking in your house. If you guys come across a green Ride the Lightning album, snatch that bitch and hold on to it.
That's like the Led Zeppelin album with the Zeppelin on it, and it's orange, I think.
Ah.
They made some of those, and that's worth a shit ton of money.
Yeah, and then there's a Bob Dylan one that's worth a lot of money, too. One of his albums is worth a shit ton of money because they released it wrong.
Mm.
And it was only like 100 of them.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, Dave Mustaine actually received writing credits for Ride the Lightning and The Call of Cthulhu.
Good for him.
He received...
With the Cthulhu. That's a great song, too.
Great song. And so, also another transition for Metallica at this point made the top 100s getting a lot more visibility. They obviously go away from shit-ass Megaforce Records and go to... Elektra Records. Sorry, we're having a little video snafu. I don't know what's going on there. Whatever, fuck it. Anyway, so they signed with Elektra Records.
Okay.
At this point.
Right.
Which is, that's a big company. That's when you know.
Oh, yeah.
That's when you know.
Yeah.
You signed with Elektra.
It doesn't matter who signed you up for Elektra. Elektra is the
That's the company. Jam, dude.
That's the diamond.
That's the jam. So after that, we'll move a little bit faster on Metallica. That's when they really blew up. They started touring with More of Their Heroes, Wasp, Armored Saint. And they also played the Monsters of Rock Festival in Donington Park, England on August 17th, 1987, with headliners Bon Jovi and Rat in front of 70,000 people.
Leave it on a prayer.
Yeah, fucking Bon Jovi. Everybody in New Jersey just jizzed their pants in unison as soon as they heard that.
Trust me, I lived it. I lived through that period in New Jersey.
Yeah. And so
my aunt would come home and be like, oh my God, a friend of a friend of a cousin of a friend knows John, and we're going to be able to meet him. You believe that? You're going to take me to meet John Bon Jovi. I'm like, what?
Cool. Let me know how it is.
She never met him.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly. And so after this, they did that 1987 tour. And so they, but a little bit before that, they started working on Master of Puppets in Copenhagen at the Sweet Silent Studios. Master of Puppets drops in 1986, spends 72 weeks on the top 100 charts, and is 6 times platinum by 2003.
Beast.
Fucking.
Beast mode.
Beast. And so they started touring again at the Master of Puppets tour, and this is where shit really takes a turn. Because this is when they're in Sweden. They're going through Sweden on their tour bus, and all the band members are sitting there, and, you know, James, Lars.
Cliff.
Yeah, James, Lawrence, Cliff, and Kirk. Yeah, that's right. They're just sitting there drawing straws for bunk positions.
Right.
You know, they're sitting there like, all right, man. Well, because they used to play magical bunks or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And so Cliff won, and he got to pick whichever bunk he was sleeping in. He chose Kirk's. And so sometime in between 2 and 3 a.m., the bus driver loses control. The bus rolls over. Everybody makes it out, but Cliff is pinned under the bus.
What a bad twist of fate.
Yep. Killing him. Yeah, squishing him dead. So that was a huge hit. Obviously, everybody loves Cliff Burton. Cliff Burton's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I thought he was fantastic player.
Of course.
So moving forward from that, they started interviewing 40 other bass players. They finally landed on Jason Newsted. And he was out of a band called Flotsam and Jetsam, which is actually a pretty good band. I listened to a little bit of their stuff yesterday while I was working in the yard. They're a pretty good band.
Yeah, okay.
You ever heard of them?
No, I've never listened.
Mm. They're pretty good. So after that, they start working on Injustice for All, which is the first album without Cliff Burton.
Another amazing album.
Fucking great album. Harvester of Sorrow and One.
Every fucking phenomenal song on the whole entire thing.
Yeah. Fucking phenomenal. This is also the first time that Metallica's seen on TV, because One was their first music video. And that dropped on MTV. So now they're on screen with everybody in America looking. And that's where they really started picking up momentum.
Mm.
That's where they started getting real big. And so we'll... when
James will start to get real drunk.
Well, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's shortly... That was in 2001 when he started getting real fucking shitty. That was when Jason Newsted left the band.
Oh.
Jason Newsted left in 2001 because he wanted to start doing
some
side
projects.
That was when
Lars and him started getting into it about his drinking.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And James was like, I don't know if I could do this sober. And Lars was like, well, I don't know if we're going to do anything anywhere again with you. I'm Lars.
Well, I kind of get it, though, man, because, like, I've always said that. It's got to be hell being, like, a heavy metal musician.
Yeah.
Because, like, how do you do that sober?
Right.
Get into that mindset, how?
Not only that, but you have to go in front of millions of people every night, and that's kind of just like your go-to ritual to give you that liquid courage.
Self-medication.
You know? Exactly.
Because, you're...
Even Mick Jagger, to this day, I saw him in an interview, he still throws up before he goes out on stage.
Does he really?
He does, yeah.
Wow.
It's just nerves, you know. You can't get rid of the stage.
Now,
stage
like,
fright.
If you're somebody like Eric Clapton or something like that, you can go out on stage sober and just sit here and jam like you would in your living room or your garage. You mean?
It depends on who you are. I mean,
right?
You know.
But
he was really bad too for a long time.
Yeah, but like, just this thrashing heavy metal music. I'd imagine that you've got to have a little bit of something in you, especially in your young days. You've got women throwing themselves at you. You've got all these tours you're on.
For me. There's blues, like Clapton, you can kind of like wing it if you're drunk, but if you're in a heavy metal band, like for me, I can't play metal after I've been drinking because the timing, it all comes down to the timing. And
right.
If you can't get, you know, that's why I don't think Kirk Hammett was a big time alcoholic.
I doubt it.
He might have did a shot or two, like, you know, before the show, but
yeah.
He doesn't come out. You
know, I can't play guitar drunk. I can't play worth a shit.
I can play slower stuff. I just, you know, but not like, you know, like you're saying, like. You know,
yeah, all no, that no. real fast tempo kind of stuff.
Nope.
So, yeah, that's when Jason Newsted left the band in 2001 because Hetfield and Lars wouldn't let him pursue his own interest. And that was also in when Hetfield joined Rehab. He was in rehab for 5 months. And they were also, while he was in rehab, they were filming a documentary called Some Kind of Monster.
Right.
And I've seen that before. Yeah.
And then that's where you kind of see the riff that they're having throughout the band.
Yeah, and that's where it kind of changed. One sort of interesting thing, I mentioned my two favorite albums, Load and Reload. You ever seen the album art for those?
Mm-mm, no.
The album art, it looks like a... here, let's pull it up real quick. It looks like a lava lamp type...
as the cover you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, I never really looked at it. I just said, that's a stupid looking cover.
That right there.
Yeah.
You know what that is?
What is it?
That's a mixture of one of their friends, Andrew's jizz and cow blood pressed between plexiglass.
See, and I always looked at that why did they pick that? I never really inquired, why did they pick that? I was kind of that's stupid looking.
And Reload was a mixture of blood and urine.
Well, they're
pressed between plexiglass.
Reloading those, that's disgusting.
I thought it was fucking hilarious. That's pretty metal. Pretty fucking metal, dude.
It's original. Yeah.
But moving forward a little bit, we'll start speeding, like I said, through Metallica. 2003, Saint Anger's released and got shit reviews.
Yeah.
Saint Anger got fucking horrible reviews.
Right.
I liked it okay.
Yeah,
but
I didn't mind it.
It wasn't my favorite thing.
No. I mean, at least they were trying to go back to their garage roots. I think that's what they were doing in that album.
Yeah. I think Garage Inc. came out in 1998.
Wait, when did that movie come out? Did you ever see that movie that they made up in Canada in that big-ass Coliseum?
Mm-hmm.
That fucking movie killed
Through the
it
Never?
That was such a fucking good fucking concert flick, dude. I love that movie.
Yeah, it's fucking great.
So original.
Yeah,
and
I love that.
And the stage sets were amazing in that
fucking
movie.
Fucking fantastic.
That's probably one of the best concert DVDs or, concert you can actually see.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. I thought it was great.
Yeah, it was great.
I thought it was fantastic.
It surprised the shit out of me. And then they had a little side story about the kids stuff. Yeah.
Running around with the guy and the horse, hanging people and shit.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a really good, well-made movie. Yeah.
And in the very beginning, James Hetfield drives by in one of his hot rods and shit.
Yep.
Looking at the kid.
I think that's what they wanted Some Kind of Monster to kind of be, but they didn't know that at the time. But then they were this is what we want.
Right.
Through the Never.
Right. Right, exactly. And so also, more notably, in 2003, they picked up former Suicidal Tendencies bassist Robert Trujillo.
Right.
Which, that guy's fucking badass, dude.
And in that movie, when he's in that room and the room's shaking and he's playing the bass, that's so cool.
Yeah. I watch him play bass and I'm like, there's nobody in this world that can play bass that low. That dude's damn near doing a split. Right.
And there's also nobody in the world who has to worry about actually breaking a bass string.
Yeah.
He probably is one of them with his gorilla fingers.
I didn't even think about that.
He's such a big dude.
Yeah.
He's like a wrestling superstar.
He looks like Brandon Small from fucking Death Clock. He looks like, you ever seen that fucking show, the cartoon show, Death Clock or Metalocalypse?
Yep.
He's all big and fucking brutal with long hair. That's what fucking Robert Trujillo looks like to me. Motherfucker's badass. So anyway, so what Metallica chose to do, vice all the other bands, is they decided to chase commercial success. They got a lot of harsh criticism from their thrash metal following. But then again, that was a smart thing because thrash metal was dying. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Thrash metal was a dying scene. That was an underground thing. And you can't be selfish and say somebody's going to sell out when they're, that's how they pay their fucking bills, man.
Yeah. And were they selling out or were they just progressing their music?
That's what I, they were progressing their music.
They were slowing it down a little bit. They started doing it in the Black Album. You really can't say that the Black Album was thrash metal.
Well, what they were doing is they were targeting all audiences.
You really can't say, to me, you really can't say after Kill 'Em All was completely thrash metal on all their albums, because they did have some certain qualities that they lost.
Oh, I think Kill 'Em All was their only
true
thrash metal
true
album.
True thrash, right.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I completely agree with you 100%.
I mean, Suicidal Tendencies did the same thing. They were super thrashy, and then when The Art of Rebellion came out, it was super melodic, which I love.
Right, because like I said, what these bands were doing that actually, because you had bands that were actually, they wanted to play music because they, this is my genre. I'm punk. This is what I'm going to do.
Right.
You had those bands, and then you had bands that, I like this music. This is what I'm going to play, but I'm going to make this my career.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And that's what Metallica did. They followed, they didn't want to stick themselves in a box. We're gonna play music that everybody can enjoy.
One band that comes across as kind of a little stuck in a box, but they still sound great, is Bad Religion.
Oh yeah, they're right up in the box.
They're so in the box.
They're in the box.
They sound great, it's funny because every album, all the songs sound different.
Right.
It's the same.
Yeah.
Sound.
Same sound.
Right.
So along the same times as Metallica starting, obviously, like we said, Dave Mustaine got booted out of the band. He formed Megadeth right after that, after arriving back in L.A. with his bandmates David Elfson and Greg Handevitt. And like I said, these guys were the kings. Well, Dave Mustaine was the king of firing motherfuckers and hiring motherfuckers and firing motherfuckers and all of this kind of
shit.
He was
thinking that, oh, I just got to sort through all the bad ones till I find a diamond in the rough that's going to, you know, be the musician that I want him to be.
Right.
Trent Reznor was the same way.
Oh, I'm sure.
With all his hiring and firing. That's why the guys, two of his bandmates, left and formed Filter because they got sick and tired of his shit.
Right. Well, when he's got a particular sound he wants, he's got a particular sound he wants.
It's different. Well, it is the same. It's the same with Dave Mustaine because it was his music and he wanted it performed probably in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't up to his standards, get the fuck out of here.
Right. So, exactly.
I mean, I don't blame the guy. That's just the way he was.
But I also think Mustaine was very, like, if
delusional.
Delusional. Yeah. Like, if you combat me on anything, because it's one thing to be, you know, be focused on your music like James Hetfield was. And there's another thing to, you know, have the inability to consume creative criticism.
Yeah.
You know, because I imagine through readings and looking at interviews and things, it's if he went against me at all, they were fucking fired.
Right. Or if you know I heard, I mean? Or he was talking behind my back and I right, found fired. Out about it, fired, fired, mm-hmm. fired.
Right.
Well, so, you know.
Yeah, whatever.
Whatever. That's how he operated. So.
Well, whatever. So 1985, they dropped Killing Is My Business and Business Is Good.
Yeah.
That was a huge thrash metal hit.
It was.
That was huge amongst the thrash metal guys. At this time, they
all
had...
All the dirty burners were buying that.
All the dirty burners. they signed on with Combat Records, which was another New York-based record company. And Mustaine was pissed about the money that they gave him to record the album. They gave him $8,000 to make the album.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave Mustaine spent half of it on drugs, alcohol, and food. $4,000. Four grand of the fucking album money. If this is any indication with where they were doing at the time, because these motherfuckers were partiers. Megadeth was partying.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and don't get me wrong, they were great musicians, but they had the catchiest album art.
Right.
Every kid was like, what's that? You know?
Yeah. Well, that was, what was it, Vic Rattlehead?
Yeah, then I knew Vic Rattlehead. Eddie from Iron Maiden, and then yeah. Vic Rattlehead.
Vic Rattlehead.
Megadeth.
Yeah, he used to come out on stage with them.
Yeah.
Every now and again, Vic Rattlehead come over and hang out.
Well, he probably saw Iron Maiden. He said, well, we got to get ourselves an Eddie.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
That's what I thought, too. I was like, that's very Iron Maiden of you, Megadeth.
It's very chintzy of you.
Yeah, right. Dave. But on their first album, Killing Is My Business and Business Is Good, like we talked about before, the Four Horsemen that Metallica put down was actually a Dave Mustaine written song. And so there was a big legal thing of, you know, about the rights to the song, and Dave Mustaine won, and they re-recorded it as Mechanics on this album.
That's interesting.
Yeah, they got writing credit for it. So after that album dropped, they went on their first North American tour with a Canadian speed metal band called Exciter, which they're pretty good. They're pretty badass band.
Yeah.
In the thrash scene, because Megadeth held true to the thrash stuff.
They did.
They held true.
But that's partly the reason why they never super exploded like Metallica did.
Right.
Because they never broke out of that thrash metal standard.
Now, Megadeth is famous in their scene.
Oh, yeah. They're head of the class.
Right. Them, you know, and so, and it's also Anthrax. Well, Anthrax went, they got a little bit bigger with their Public Enemy stuff.
That's what I'm saying. They branched out.
Yeah, they branched out a little bit. But I would say Slayer and Megadeth are the two bands that actually really held true. Because you see what Slayer did. We were talking about their second or third album that they dropped, they slowed it down just a little bit.
Right.
And they were like, they got blasted about it, so they turned the fucking heat right back up.
Well, Dave Mustaine kind of did the same thing when Symphony of Destruction came out.
Right.
You know, there was a couple songs on there.
Great song. Oh, great album.
My favorite song by him is A Secret Place.
Mm-hmm.
Love that song.
Great. And he's a fantastic guitar player, too.
Oh, yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, man, when I was like, probably 7 or 8 years old, the only thing in this world that I wanted was a Dave Mustaine Flying V. A Dean Dave Mustaine Flying V.
Right.
I wanted it so fucking bad, white with the gold inlay. Yeah. I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
I think Flying V's are ridiculous now, but they're ridiculous guitars.
Or the Dimebag Darrell.
Yeah, more ridiculous. The most ridiculous.
Dean Flying V.
Yeah, that is the most ridiculous. But yeah, I always wanted one of those. So this is also after that, like I said, after... after their Killing Is My Business and Business Is Good. They go on tour a little bit, and then they drop their second album, which was their big one. They dropped that in late 86, Peace Sells, But Who's Buying?
Right.
That was the big one. That was the monster.
Vic was on the cover.
Vic was on the cover doing his thing. And once again, there's something to be said about them because they were staying true to their thrash metal roots.
Yep.
Right? And so while on tour with their album, their Peace Sells, But Who's Buying, they were on tour with Alice Cooper in 87 on the Constrictor tour, and they started going through a shit ton of personnel changes. Mm-hmm. I mean an absolute ton. Their drummer Samuelson was getting too hard into drugs. His guitar player Chris Poland was accused of selling the band's equipment to buy drugs, so they were both fired, and then Chuck Buehler became the band's full-time drummer at that time.
What they don't tell you is that Dave Mustaine ordered them to do so and then fired them the next day.
Yeah. He was fucking banging
drugs.
What
do you mean you sold our half stacks?
Yeah.
You're fired.
Told him to go do it.
Oh, I told him to do that, didn't I?
Was all geeked out on heroin and fucking fired him for it because he forgot. But and then the very next year, they were pumping albums out fucking left and right. They were killing it. 88, they dropped So Far, So Good, So What. That was a mediocre success, but Mustaine was starting to struggle with his drug addiction pretty heavily at that time.
Wasn't Rust in Peace, wasn't that one of them?
Yeah, that was that dropped in 1990.
Okay.
Yep.
And then Symphony of Destruction.
And then Symphony, yep. So Rust in Peace was number 2 on the United States charts and number 8 in the UK. So they got a pretty good amount of fan base from that. They got a good amount of publicity for that album, not as much as their previous two, but
right.
That, and I think it was indicative of his drug abuse that was falling into the music.
Mm-hmm.
But on that tour, that's when they joined Slayer, Testament, and Suicidal Tendencies for the Clash of the Titans European tour, which is fucking badass.
Yeah, dude, that would have been sick.
God, how many pregnancies do you think happened? Yeah. How many people went to the hospital? Yeah. And even so we're talking about 1990. This is when the quote-unquote grunge scene was coming on the scene, and so Alice in Chains started touring with them.
Yeah.
They started touring because they did an American leg of the Clash of the Titans tour, and they did that with Slayer and Anthrax, and Alice in Chains was the opener.
Anthrax did a tour with White Zombie as well.
Did he?
Yeah.
That's pretty fucking rad. Well, I think we're going to have to get into Anthrax and Slayer next week.
No doubt.
Yeah, I think so. No doubt. Bass, how low can you go?
Halfway.
Halfway. So, yeah, moving a little bit further with and finishing up with Megadeth. These guys came out with a lot of great albums. I think they had 12 studio albums after Rust in Peace came out in 1990. They had Countdown to Extinction in 1992, Euthanasia in 1994, Cryptic Writings in 1997, Risk in 1999, World Needs a New Hero in 2001. The system has failed in 2004.
Let's just say the record sales kind of went down a notch.
Yeah.
Since Countdown to Extinction and what they, I'm sure they went down.
But
down,
I'm
down.
Telling you, man, for like a 20 or 30 year span, with a 30 year span, these guys didn't go more than 3 years without dropping an album.
Yeah, because bills need to get paid. They need to go on tour. The tours generate the money that they to sustain the Mustaine.
The sustain the Mustaine in the main vein of the Mustaine.
Exactly.
like I said, we're going to get a little bit more into Anthrax and Slayer next week. And Slayer and Anthrax, they had a very huge depiction on the scene. They were the greatest. They were the absolute greatest. There was nothing any better. It's going to be big, real big.
Huge.
So we'll get into them a little bit next week. And I think Anthrax, something cool about them. I always loved that work that they did with Public Enemy.
Yeah.
That was fucking cool.
And that was on the soundtrack for Judgment Night.
And that was also on Tony Hawk's Pro Skater.
It also was on the soundtrack for Judgment Night when it released.
Mm.
That's where it came from.
Well, that's cool.
There was a lot of cool songs on that. The Judgment Night soundtrack, yeah.
Anthrax, and like we said before, Anthrax, they stayed pretty tight with their thrash metal roots. They branched out a little bit, but they always came back.
Yeah, they pulled the reins in real quick after that album.
They pulled the reins in real quick. And, Slayer did the same thing.
I'm the Man. That's my favorite Anthrax.
I'm the Man. Yeah. So South of Heaven from Slayer, they did the same thing. They released, you know, Show No Mercy, Hell Awaits, Rain and Blood, which was a fucking smackdown hit. And then, you know, South of Heaven, that's when they slowed it down a little bit. They got a lot of scrutiny for it and then picked it back up with their next album in 1990, Seasons of the Abyss. Yeah. So we'll get into those cats a little bit more next week. So let's talk about, in our album review of the week, let's talk about Tool's Fear Inoculum. What do you think about it, Mark?
I think they're talented musicians.
Think what you think about them personally. What did you think about the album?
Well, I wanted to love it, and I ended up barely even liking it.
Yeah.
I just feel like they regurgitated a bunch of their old stuff to make money. I think that they said, hey, you know what? Let's release all of our streaming stuff, all of our albums, and then we'll get tons of money. But then on top of it, we'll release a new album, and then we'll just reprocess some of our old album and then we'll go on tour, and we'll make a lot of money.
I think you're exactly right.
Because they are about business. Maybe not 20 years ago, but today it's all about making money.
Right. And the one thing I did like is the typical Tool fashion is the whole album sound like one continuous song.
They added a little bit of the synthesizer, corny ass shit.
Yeah. And that the third song on the record, that's a French name, Litanie contre la peur. Or whatever it is, I thought that was fucking ridiculous. It was a ridiculous transition.
Yeah.
It was a good album as far as production. You know, and when I need to clean my bathroom or something, I'll put it on. You know, when I'm not sitting there focusing on it.
A buddy of mine today said, "You didn't like that Fear."
Inoculum?
You don't like that? I mean, inoculum, you fucking...
Moran? So my assessment of it, for what it's worth, is I appreciate the effort in streaming your songs. I think you're exactly right, like I said. I appreciate the album itself and what it is, but I do feel like it's lazy. Mm-hmm. There is no hard-hitting vocal singles. Not saying every album needs a single, but it's indicative in Tool's nature to have at least one or two hard-hitting vocal breakdown singles on an album.
Mm-hmm.
There was none of that. There was a lot of build-up for nothing. I think it was very lazy, and I think it sounded like a C-side track or a C-side to Lateralis.
That's correct.
You know what I mean? It's the same guitar riffs and drum lines that I've been listening to for 20 years.
Yes.
Nothing different.
Really, nothing different.
That's exactly
how I thought about it.
It was like a sad face blowjob or
I wish we had our friends Drew and Mike Martinez here, because those guys would argue a point, because we're kind of one-sided on the subject. I would like to have somebody else to bounce off of. So in the future, if we get one of those guys to do a guest host with us, we will revisit the Fear Tool Inoculum.
Yeah, the Fear Inoculum album. And also, if you guys have any feedback on it, feel free to email me at willywhitebread69@gmail.com. We can talk back and forth a little bit about it. But like I said, I feel like it's lazy. It left a lot to be desired, and it just wasn't typical. It was too typical Tool for me.
They're milking that cash cow for all.
Milking the name. And it took too fucking long to write for it to be that shitty.
Yeah.
Well, I shouldn't say shitty. It's not a shitty album. I was saying, it's disappointed.
Exactly. And Tool fans will be like, oh, it's so technical, and that's their sound. That's their signature sound.
Yeah, but it's the same sound.
It's the same riffs.
It's the same riff.
Just in different, you know, backwards or mixed up.
Right.
It was
disappointing. It was lazy.
Very disappointing.
Right. So anyway, I also wanted to do a little quip. There's a new music store over here in, obviously you guys know that we record in Jacksonville, Florida. I live over here in the Murray Hill region. There's a new record store that just opened up. I should say record store and vintage audio gear and equipment store that opened up at 807 Edgewood Avenue South. It's called the Murray Hill Music Factory. I've been in there probably 3 or 4 times in the last week since I found it, because it's actually a real fucking record store. Not one of these, oh, it smells good, and there's just nicely placed everything, and all the vinyl is nice and brand new, and I'm going to charge $35 for a brand new print. No, this is a real record store with original prints, all original vinyl, and these guys probably have the most extreme vinyl collection I've ever seen in my fucking life. And for great prices, I picked up a copy of Janis Joplin's Pearl and an original self-titled Bad Company record for about $20. You know, the guy's a... the technicians there, Randy and Will. Randy's a certified luthier. He's been there for 45 years. They've got vintage Gibsons on the wall, vintage Fenders. They've got all sorts of vintage harmonies and a great selection of, you know, acoustic and electric guitars, as well as amps and everything like that. And he'll work on your vintage electronics too, which is very difficult to find somebody that'll work on vintage electronics. So I just wanted to give those guys a little shout out because they're a real record store and I appreciate them being in the area. So next week, guys, we're going to go a little bit further into the origins of thrash metal. We're going to go into Anthrax. We're going to talk about Slayer, and then we're going to move on a little bit forward from that to the power metal scene, the new wave metal scene, and all things pertaining. So stay tuned for next week, guys. As always, we love you. Come on back.
Looking forward to it. Later.